Now in depth on rough justice and tempered mercy. That's how the cops of the Manhattan North Special Force work their turf in Don Winslow's new novel. They're detective kings, earning respect, playing the system, edging ever closer to the line. People forget Denny Malone, the king of those detective kings, tells us. The cops see first the victims and then the perpetrators. As Don Winslow joins us, I'd like to hear from you, particularly if you're in some position in law enforcement or criminal justice. What's most misunderstood about the work you do and who you are? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Don Winslow is the author of The Cartel. You can find our interview about that novel on the podcast. His new novel is titled The Force, and he joins us today from New York City. And Don, it's such a pleasure to have you back. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
You know, I've been recently reading up on the subject of traumatic grief, and it occurred to me that the police officers in this novel and the police officers that you hung out with as you researched this have a lot of traumatic grief over what they've seen and some of the things that they've had to do. And I wonder if they acknowledge that to you.
Oh, sure. You know, look, I mean, I spoke to a lot of cops and over the course of years, and so the experiences are all different. You know, some were fairly reticent, some opened up. For the most part, it took time. I also, though, consulted with psychologists and therapists who treat post-traumatic stress disorder, and 80% of their clients are cops and first responders.
Does that mean that it is the stigma has fallen away a bit for police officers who are willing to say, I can't cope with this on my own, and that they are seeking help and that they can speak openly about it with their colleagues?
You know, I don't think that the stigma has completely fallen away. I think that there's still a lot of that there, you know, and I think that some of that is necessary to do the job. Some of it is sort of fronting to the public or to, you know, colleagues and coworkers. Others of it is a psychological defense mechanism that is saying, I can't let this get to me. This won't get to me. On the other hand, I think that there is a greater awareness that it does have a tremendous effect on these officers and their families and their loved ones, and people are a bit more willing to come out about it.
Is a career affected if it becomes known that you've sought out some kind of psychological help as a police officer?
Depends on who you work for. It depends on the force. It depends on your boss. It depends on where you are and sort of who you are in that system.
That sentence that I quoted from your novel about the cops seeing the victims and then the perpetrators, the next paragraph says, the cops feel for the vics and hate the perps, but they can't feel too much or they can't do their jobs, and they can't hate too much or they'll become the perps. There's a lot of observation and knowledge packed into that paragraph that I assume you acquired as you were doing this research and hanging out with this force. What did you see as it relates to that?
You know, I think that one thing that I saw was how deeply police feel about the victims. We tend to think, because of pop culture and, you know, movies and books, and I'm guilty of this too, that the primary relationship a cop has on the job is between the cop and the perpetrator, the cop and the criminal. When you think about it, that's not really true. The first person that a cop sees going on a scene is usually, most often, the victim. It's the cop that deals with the pain of that. It's the cop that has to knock on somebody's door to tell them that their loved one is never coming home. You know, and I had police who talked about cases from decades ago who very suddenly got quite emotional about it, recalling those cases. So I think that's something that I really learned in the course of researching this book.
Your reading that reminded me of a book I've just finished about from somebody, Boz Dreisinger, who writes about prisons in New York and around the world. And one of the things that she constantly reminds herself as she goes into these prisons and interacts with the people there, that they, most of them, were victims first, and then perpetrators, and then maybe victims again, and then maybe perpetrators again. That often committing a crime begins with an experience of having been a victim. Now, how does that sound to you?
Well, it sounds accurate to me. Look, I mean, we have a cycle of abuse that goes on generationally, doesn't it? You know, when you look at criminals, very often you are looking at people who have been abused. There's always a reason that they do what they do. We might not like the reason. We might not want to coddle to that. But there's always a reason behind everything, isn't there?
You know, you were long since finished with your book, and I had finished reading it when the president, I think, made those remarks maybe a couple weeks ago about not being too nice to perpetrators. And law enforcement, I think, some law enforcement came out to say that they didn't agree with that. What was your thought about that, having had the kind of experiences you've had in researching the book?
Well, it was an unfortunate thing to say, and I think that most police departments came out against it immediately. I talked to several cops in the aftermath of that, fairly high-ranking officers who were pretty offended by those comments.
And tell me why. Yeah.
Well, because it speaks directly to the sort of thing that they are trying to combat. You know, is that quick and easy sort of misjustice, the mistreatment of prisoners, that's not what most police want to do. It's not the way that they want to be perceived. It's not the way that they want their officers behaving. So when it's encouraged in sort of a smirky fashion from, you know, the highest position in the land, it's unfortunate.
Does it also reveal that he doesn't really understand the culture of law enforcement?
Well, I think that's true as well. But then again, most people don't. And, you know, not to single out the president for this, I think that as a society, we're conflicted about what we want from police and what we expect. On the one hand, we want perfect safety. On the other hand, you know, we want perfect privacy. We want to be secure on our streets 100%. But on the other hand, you know, we always want all of our rights. This is a tough balancing act to pull off for police.
Yeah, this is so true, Don. I mean, I was thinking this morning as I listened to what law enforcement are doing in a place like Houston.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right? Running toward the danger, helping
right.
people who would have no other way to get out. And I thought about those oppositional expectations that we have of police officers and how disorienting that must be day to day.
Completely. And all the more so because now everyone in the country is a journalist, right? Because we
right.
all carry those phones with the video cameras on them. And police are more and more aware that they're constantly in the public eye. You know, this book is dedicated to 187 police officers who were killed in the line of duty just while I was typing the manuscript.
Yeah, I think about the message that came out of Dallas. And there are some references at the beginning of the book to what happened, those ambushes in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a huge transformational blow that was to a department like Dallas. But also, as you note, I mean, the adversarial relationship that police officers, some of their own making, have with the communities that they police.
There can be, I call it the erosive factor.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
No. What do you mean?
The way we police now is basically by response as opposed to prevention. And so police are called in. When are they called in? When bad things are happening. So typically that's all they see. Now, again, that's a gross generalization, and, you know, it varies from department to department and assignment to assignment. That might not be everyone's experience. And so they too often, however, come to view those communities and those people as things where bad things happen, and that over the course of a career, I think erodes morale and erodes their view of the community, as it does the community image of the police.
Right.
But we expect, our expectations now, because of you know, of holes in our budgets, in terms, particularly in terms of health. We expect our police now to be guardians, protectors, prosecutors, but also mental health specialists and EMTs. It's far too heavy a burden.
Don Winslow is with us. If you've just joined us, it's a conversation about the culture of policing and the things that he learned as he researched his new novel, The Force. It's about an elite force in Manhattan and some of the things that he learned as he observed them and has put into a great yarn of a novel. 651-227-6000, as you think about if you're in criminal justice, some position in law enforcement or criminal justice, what do you think is most misunderstood about what you do? And maybe it touches on some of the things that we've been talking about. 800-242-2828, and then on Twitter at CarrieMPR. You know, I wondered in contemplating your characters in the novel whether most really accomplished, really great cops are anti-authoritarian, which is kind of interesting given that they are perceived as authority figures, but have a hard time. The really good ones have a hard time, you know, being under someone else's authority.
Yeah, I think that that can be true. Now, that can be something of a cliche. You know, we look at the Dirty Harrys and, you know, there's a sort of a stereotype about the cop who doesn't play by the rules and, you know, and is always aggravating his or her superiors. These kind of cops, though, who are very effective, they do have a certain kind of charisma, a certain kind of star power. They can be very, very charming, extremely persuasive, and almost artistic in the way they go about doing what they do. Very creative, you know. And I think that that does help them succeed in their jobs. And again, it's a certain sort of defense mechanism as well.
You know, it's an interesting word, artistic. I wouldn't have thought of that. Would you say something more about that, what you saw?
Yeah, I mean, I think that cops investigating certain kinds of cases or even just dealing with the public on a daily basis need to be very creative. They're very verbally skilled. They're verbally artistic in terms of facing down a situation, trying to talk a situation down as opposed to getting into a confrontation. They can be very creative about solving problems on the street. And then when investigating a case, you know, it takes a certain kind of creativity, a certain kind of imagination and artistry to put a case together.
They probably don't get enough credit for that, as you've described it. Do cops talk about fear, and how do they talk about it?
They don't talk about it a lot. You know, it's sort of the whistling past the graveyard. If you pretend it doesn't exist, it doesn't exist. But every once in a while, certainly you do hear cops talk about, yeah, it's scary out there, you know. And, you know, it's funny. Sometimes you hear people say, well, why didn't the cop just shoot him in the foot or shoot him
right.
in the hand or something? And,
right.
and I don't think that people realize how quickly these situations occur, the amount of adrenaline that's coursing through your system, the decisions that have to be made in an extremely short period of time, and the fear factor that really is out there. When you look at some of these, you know, quote, bad shootings, and they are, I think fear has played a tremendous factor in that. The cop was simply scared. And that is an element of either recruiting or training.
See, I think so, too. And we have a police shooting that is being investigated now.
Of course.
The Hennepin County attorney has not decided whether he's going to charge the police officer. But from the outside looking in with no more knowledge than anybody else, it does seem that fear had to be a factor for why the police officer reacted as he did. Can you, as a police officer, admit that? And I think if police officers talked more openly about that, maybe the community might see it differently. What do you think?
Well, I think that would be a positive step. I think that the key to a lot of the problems that we're experiencing right now, and this is what police officers tell me, is in recruiting and is in training. Let's be really honest. Some people shouldn't be cops. either because there is a racial bias, there might be a weak ego, which makes them brittle in a conflict situation, and so makes them push it to the next level when it really doesn't need to be there. And there might just be too great an element of fear. And recruiting and training can play a great part in this. But I agree with you. I wish that departments got out there and talked about these elements more than they do.
Call from Jim in St. Paul. Hey, Jim, what are you thinking about as you listen? Hi.
Well, so my question was, I felt like the guest up until a few minutes ago was being a bit of an apologist for what I feel like is a police culture that protects bad cops and protects even departments that seem to be more focused on protecting their own and less about being held accountable for what have been at times, let's face it, poor decision-making, if whether it's the Flandre Castillo-ish situation or the recent Ruscek killing. Mm-hmm. And it just feels like whether it's union rules or a culture, there's not a lot of accountability when bad decisions are made. And I think that has, more than anything, eroded public confidence in the cops. And so people talk about more training and that sort of thing. And I would say, how about just simple punishment and accountability? I mean, when I speed on the roads, I don't get more training. I get a ticket. I get accountability. And that's what the cops need. When they make a mistake, there needs to be accountability for that.
Don, what do you think?
Well, I certainly agree there needs to be accountability for that. I agree with your callers, Jim. But here's the problem with that. That only treats bad things that have already happened. And I think we need to be more interested in prevention as well as accountability. And the key to prevention is recruiting and training.
I would think, you said a moment ago that, let's face it, there are some people who simply shouldn't be cops. I would think that most of the people in the department know exactly who those people are, too.
Well, again, that depends. If you're looking at, for instance, the New York Police Department, you're talking about 38,000 officers. There's no way to know,
right,
you know, who those people are.
But within your circle, within your sphere, within your, you know, unit, don't most of them know that?
Yeah, I think that they know that pretty quickly.
What was the most unpredictable? How many years did you kind of come in and out as you were hanging out?
Oh, my whole life.
Yeah, your whole life.
Yeah. You know, my godfather was a police officer. I was a private investigator. I worked with police. I worked, frankly, against police as well on certain cases. The intense sort of, you know, specifically directed research for this book lasted about 5 years, but it's been a decades-long conversation.
I was going to ask you what the most unpredictable situation that you observed as you were just deep in the research for this novel. And I don't necessarily mean where guns were involved, just where you really watched the officers have to figure this out in a very difficult and fast-moving situation.
You know, I think that there are a number of street confrontations that we have seen go wrong, but more often you see them go right, where police officers confronted with especially a mentally ill person, and by the way, that's increasingly common. Our jails have become the de facto mental health centers in the United States, where cops have been amazingly creative about, you know, de-escalating a literally insane situation.
Agreed.
And talking it down. Yeah, absolutely.
That's such a no-win so often for police officers.
One of the most, unpredictable things that I saw was where homeless people were being beaten. I think I can say it, in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And this police captain was extremely upset about it and figured out that he could put dummies out in these situations to lure the perpetrator in.
Wow.
And then put surveillance around the dummies. And sure enough, within 48 hours, he had the perpetrator.
Wow, that is crazy. There's the creativity and artistry.
There's the creativity. And there's someone, again, who was caring about people that we often, frankly, don't care about. They're not high priority cases. To this cop, they were high priority cases, and he solved it.
Call here from Brian in Minneapolis. Hi, Brian. Glad you heard the conversation.
Yeah, I'd like to touch base on policing and fear, mm-hmm. as you were referring to earlier. Early in a career, you kind of come in with preconceived ideas about what your fears are going to be. So in my experience, it was dreams about fighting and shooting, etc. And through the years, actually what I ended up experiencing in a traffic unit was the fear of being struck by a vehicle became very real and more common.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that, honestly, the dreams about fear evolved into being hit by vehicles as opposed to being involved in physical altercations.
Mm-hmm.
So referring to the way police behave, part of it is based on that individual's experience on the road in the community they work in. And NYPD would be a very different experience than, say, rural Minnesota policing.
So, Brian, it sounds like you were very aware that this fear was present, especially if you were dreaming about it. Is that the kind of thing that you would say, I could use somebody to talk this out with so that I can put it in some kind of perspective, or not?
Sort of. I mean, it wasn't a thing that followed me or changed the way that I behaved, but it's the same way that anyone would take home things from work, and it might appear in your thought process or even in your dreams.
Yeah.
And it's not so much that fear is driving the way you behave, but mm-hmm. The way you interact in stressful situations or when adrenaline is dumping is definitely molded by fear. And in the early training, and the younger officers come in with what's been ingrained in them through culture and media and their own ideas about what policing is going to be about. And when you're there, it evolves and your fears evolve with it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Don Wood, Brian, thanks so much for the call. What he said about kind of the ideal that the younger officers come in with, shaped by popular culture, as all of our perceptions of what policing is all about. And then the reality sets in, I guess.
No, I agree. And first of all, Brian, thank you for everything that you do, you know. He had some fascinating things to say about fear, and certainly, you know, the gunplay is a relatively minor part, although that's, of course, you know, what we typically see and what reaches our attention. But certainly a lot of officers, you know, who are killed by vehicles, sometimes intentionally, by the way. But yeah, I think, look, every aspect of society is shaped by pop culture. You know, I've written about criminals, frankly, far more than I've written about cops.
Yeah.
And they see themselves portrayed. And then the phenomenon that we see later is that they start behaving like they see gangsters in the movies. The more serious effect has been what we refer to as the CSI effect among juries, where juries assume that there's always a smoking gun, if you will, of scientific evidence to every crime. And now they expect to see that. And if they don't see that, they're reluctant to convict.
We had a call here from somebody who wants to remain anonymous who says, I'm a former corrections officer. When a report is heard on the news of a murder or a crime, people have no idea what the police are dealing with. But I would see crime scene photographs. I have nothing but respect for them. The public's unaware of what's going on. And a call here from Reggie in Eagan. Hi, Reggie.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. What are you thinking about?
As a black man, you know, I can't help but sympathize with these officers, but at the same time have some kind of, you know, thing against them because I have been mistreated by the police, but I've also been held by the police. And, you know, I can only imagine some of the horrific things you guys go to and, you know, what that does to you mentally and spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it just seems like you would think the good officers would do more to whistleblow on the bad officers that are making it hard for people out here in these streets. Now, some people, I hate to say it, but some people do deserve to get roughed up because of the way that they act. I mean, it's just certain ways you approach a police officer, but I've seen more tolerance with white men than black men, but some people do cause, you know, bad stuff to happen to themselves.
Don, what do you think?
Look, I think that there's no question that there is a racial problem among police departments in the United States. Police departments have apologized for it historically. So when we look at the numbers, when we look at the stats, when we look at real experiences, I don't think that we can deny that. And research shows us that white people, let's just be blunt about it, and white cops tend to be more afraid of African-American males than they are of other people. For instance, research shows that a white police officer tends to overestimate the age of an African-American male. That seems like sort of an innocuous stat, but what that does is it instantly raises the potential threat level in that officer's mind. That's the bad news. But I think that we need to accept that as a reality before we can move on and address it. Again, the good news is, though, that recruiting and especially training can ameliorate that and help that situation. But there is no question that there's a racial bias there.
You know, listening to you, I was reminded of a show that we did a few months ago, and I was reading some research about the after-incident reports and what the officers say about these confrontations. You know, they're using terms like he looked like a demon, and what you said about overestimating the age and the size and the weight, particularly when an African-American man is involved in this. I mean, this comes back to that, what we were talking about, perception and fear, and then how to train for that, right? I wonder if they've figured out good ways to train for that, because that's...
Well, they are. I think that there's been some great work done on this at the University of Southern California, USC, the University of North Carolina, a lot of studies and a lot of training. But let's be very, very clear about racism among police departments. Are cops racist? I would say yes, to the same extent that society is racist. So, you know, it's not just a police problem. It's a societal problem.
We had a call here from someone else who wants to remain anonymous who says, I had a father who was in law enforcement. Fear is the most dangerous thing. Things can happen really quickly. Most cops will admit that they are most dangerous when they're afraid. That's when people get shot. And domestics are the worst situations. Is that something officers tell you, Don?
Yes, absolutely.
Why?
Because they are so emotional and they are so unexpected, and because domestics are, of course, a very, very common call, perhaps the most common. Mm-hmm. So cops are going out to them all of the time. They don't have their defenses up as much as they might have, let's say, during a drug bust or in response to a robbery where they have an expectation that people are armed. Yeah. And those domestic situations very often are alcohol and drug fueled, or they're fueled by mental illness. They can be extremely volatile, and police have a hard time, frankly, watching their backs.
Sounds like a film is in the making of Cartel, your last novel, and there's going to be a movie made of The Force. Is that right?
Yeah, both these things are correct. Yeah. Ridley Scott.
You can be a little more excited about that, Don, because, wow, that's great.
Ridley Scott, yeah, listen, I'm thrilled, you know, but I don't want to be crowing. You know, that's unbecoming.
This is not a crow-free zone here, Don. You can crow. Hey, here's the thing I was curious about. Do you go to the movie sets when films are made out of your books?
I go to say hello. Do you know what I mean? And I go to be polite. And I do have input, you know, in terms of the script and things. They talk to me. So I'll show up, but I don't want to be that guy bugging people, you know, on the set. That's not my job. They don't need me doing that. But yeah, listen, I mean, David Mamet's writing the screenplay for The Force.
Oh, so, my gosh.
Honestly.
Wow.
Huh?
Oh.
So as much of a crow as that, and Ridley Scott's directing Cartel. So yeah, I'm excited.
You're such a great guest. I really love interviewing you. Thank you. Thanks very much for this.
It's always nice to be on the show. You're a terrific host, and thank you very much.
Don Winslow's new novel is called The Force.